Welcome to the 50th episode of the Corporate Real Estate Insider Podcast. It's been a long road to get to our first big milestone here with episode 50. We have an awesome episode today talking about a wide variety of things, talking about construction costs, talking about some of the investors that are more bullish on the office market, talking about conversions, also talking about what the federal government is up to with DOGE and canceling all of these leases. Really interesting stuff on today's episode. Owen, why don't you start us off talking about that one investor group that's bought $500 million of property around some of these major markets, really betting on the return of the office market?
So it's a group called Namdar Realty Group, and they're out of New York. And this company is actually the largest private owner of shopping malls in the nation. I mean, these guys own 175 properties totaling about 57 million square feet. So big company. And in 2021, they started to look at office spaces like, hey, maybe this is something we can be buying in light of what opportunities might exist in the future. And so now they own 22 office buildings in New York, in Chicago, and in Cleveland, totaling about 7 million square feet. Now, if you haven't heard of this group, they don't have the best reputation in terms of public sentiment because they are notorious for squeezing out cash of dying malls. And they're trying to use that playbook for distressed office buildings. And when I say squeezing cash out of dying malls, the reports across the country are they buy these malls that are in distress and basically try and squeeze every single dollar out of operating efficiency and just let the mall continue to operate as it is. They don't go in and spend a bunch of money fixing them up. Now, they may have a different approach with office, but nevertheless, since 21, they've spent over $500 million acquiring in these office buildings with the hopes that the office market will rebound and they'll come out on top. And so the question is this group, like, would you consider them a visionary investor or just another cost-cutting opportunist? Did they start too early in 2021? Should they have waited till now? It remains to be seen, but that's what they're betting on, is that office will return and that they're going to come out on top buying these buildings for literally, you know, 10 cents on the dollar in some cases. So we'd love to hear what my teammates think about this one.
Yeah, pretty interesting. I, you know, to your question on did they start too early, 2021 to me seems really early to be buying distressed when the market continues to get more and more distressed. I think in some tertiary markets, they mentioned Cleveland in that article, it might be, you know, it may have hit the bottom, but I know here on the East Coast in Boston, we're just starting to see an uptick in properties coming to market. So there's a number of vacant life science buildings that are at various stages of construction. Some are completed, some have just started construction that have come to market in distressed sales. We just had one Lincoln Street that is now going up for auction that's owned by Fortis Investments. They just did a major lease in a like 150,000 foot lease in the building. It could be higher, 200,000 feet, but they had major exposure to WeWork, and the building was just announced it's going up for auction. So when the big players, if you think the Brookfields, the SL Greens, Blackstones, Starwoods are still on the sidelines and really focusing on buying distressed debt. If you notice, the distressed debt market has been on fire or just a lot more aggressive, and the buildings haven't really traded yet. I think it's still too early to be in the position they're in of having already deployed $500 billion in capital, personally.
Something that I think about often is that when you're making an investment, there's a bunch of ways to make money, right? And I think like common sentiment is that if you want to have above market returns, then you need some contrarian view. And it doesn't need to be a crazy contrarian view. It just, if you have the same view as everyone else, then it's sort of already priced into the market, right? Like if you're buying office buildings, when everyone's buying office buildings and you share the sentiment of everyone of like, okay, like maybe these buildings are going to do well, maybe these ones won't, you're probably just going to end up getting a market return, right? And at that point, it's like, why go through all the effort when you can just invest in, you know, BREIT or someone else that's like so big that more or less they're probably going to be getting a market return. And you know, if you're early, you're wrong, right, in investing. So, you know, will they still do well? Sure. Could they have done better if they waited? Sure. But you can also make money being contrarian about timing, right? Like there's a lot of investors that have famously made fortunes by saying, hey, this industry is in secular decline, but we think that it is declining slower than how other people think it's declining. And if you think of everything, if you're valuing everything ultimately on like a net present value of future cash flows basis, it's like it sort of makes sense. If you think that something's deteriorating at 10% a year and the market thinks it's deteriorating at 20% a year, then you should be willing to pay a lot more for that asset, or at least be willing to pay what other people are offering to pay, but with some value arbitrage from things not deteriorating as quickly. And when you think about the types of assets that they're buying, I would argue that they are early. I think that they probably still will do pretty well, but there's different points of being early. Like if you're a Class B office investor, I think you're even early right now. I think you're probably going to be early a year or two or 3 years from now, potentially, because these buildings are effectively worthless in many situations. It's not like they're giving them away for zero, right? But like there may be a point where the value is so low that it's really just like somebody come in and cover our carry costs, or it's a bank trying to get rid of having to carry the carry costs. So at the same time, if you're a Class A office investor, like Class A plus trophy investor, I think you're late, right? Like you just are. The time to invest in that type of asset was in the chaos of early days of COVID, where everyone was work from home, even across Class A assets, and nobody really knew what was going to happen. Now it's widely known in the, you know, corporate real estate market that we have very strong performance in the best assets across the country, and we can't really create more of them because construction costs are so incredibly high, both for core and shell construction, like base building construction, and then also for tenant improvements.
Let me ask you a question on that, Tucker. If you're sitting on the sidelines and you have a development site to build Class A plus office, are you early, late, or are you going right now in a core market?
I think it depends a lot on the core market. I mean, I think you'd be literally out of your mind to build Class A plus office space in basically anywhere in Los Angeles on a speculative basis. If you have an anchor tenant for 60 or 70% of your building, okay, great. I mean, in markets like New York, okay, maybe a different story. And you've seen people make those types of bets. So I think it just really is market dependent. But you know, personally, if I had a, you know, Class A plus trophy office development site, I would try and prove that there's demand for it by getting some sort of anchor tenant or turning into some sort of partial build-to-suit instead of going spec. What would you do, Ryan?
Yeah, I think you and I look at this the same way. I think if it was somebody else's money, I would be very bullish on going spec in a number of markets. Boston, if you had the right site, Boston, New York, Austin, in the right location, like in the domain, but there's very few of those. And, those developers are going to kill it, right? So, the demand for that type of product in the right location is unmet and will continue to be unmet in the market for many years to come, in my opinion, because people are gravitating towards quality. And it's actually great as a broker working with clients. You know, if it's like when you go in and look at houses and you look at the broker shows you the house in your price range, say it's $500,000. They say, you know what, we should go look at this other house. I know it's a little bit outside your price range. And you go there and you're like, this is amazing. I love this house. And you reach yeah. and you reach for it, right? I think we're in the point in commercial real estate where clients are seeing that and they're reaching for things, and they're so thankful that they're making those decisions to improve the quality of the space that they're going into. And the more opportunities that we can do that, the more product on the market that helps keep those pricings in check, the better our job is and the more happy our clients will be. So, you know, selfishly, I'd love to see more speculative office, high quality office development, because all the good stuff's been leased.
So we should use that as a segue to talk about cost of construction. I wanted to bring this up. We've got a couple office requirements we're running here in San Diego in the 30,000 square foot range. And our project manager took a look at one of the plans and came back with an initial budget, you know, all in of $300 a square foot. And we thought, that can't be true. That can't be right for Southern California. And if it's true, it makes it very difficult or impossible to transact. And so we went back and we squeezed the numbers and challenged and took out some of the contingencies. And so here are the basic numbers. Hasn't it always been true that the tenant improvement allowance never gets you all the way there? At best, it's a generous number, but it typically doesn't include the furniture, the fixtures, equipment, the move, the IV, AV and IT. So here are the numbers from a tenant perspective. And this is pretty tight. So construction from a warm shell is going to be $150 a foot. The furniture, which I know can be arranged depending what you buy it. Let's say the range is 25 to 75. So we've got $35 a square foot in for furniture. 15 for the architect, 15 for IT and AV, another 5 for security and 5 for the actual move. So $225 a foot is what it's going to cost in Southern California to, from a tenant's perspective, to an effect a build out from a warm shell. And this landlord's offering is $100. Makes it really, really hard to transact. I think, Brian, you mentioned your numbers in Boston are even higher.
They are. Just for context, what do you think the office to open ratio is at that space that you're describing?
Yeah. Less than 50% private office, 40% private.
Yeah. So it's in, you know, in our world, that's a pretty lower end build for quality space because it has minimal private offices, or not minimal, but it has, kind of a standard ratio of private office.
Your walls.
Yeah. Yeah. Here it's crazy. You have costs that can get up into $400 a foot easy, for a law firm space easy. But the, you know, $300 to $350 for all in furniture, AV, all your FF&Es is really what the budget should be up here in New England. Certainly in downtown Boston. Yeah, union market, very expensive labor market, very expensive cost of construction, very expensive and time-consuming permitting and entitlements, whatever you need to do for, you know, for those types of costs. So it's extremely cost prohibitive. And it's funny, just this morning, I was having the conversation begging a client that has no interest in moving to go out and tour the market. And it's not where I can, you know, we can save 5%. It could be 20% easy off of what the asking rents are, where they would renew versus what a deal should get struck at if we go and evaluate the market. And by the way, they might find something they like better. That's, you know, that has some level of finishes left. But I would tell you the other side of it is never in my career have I seen large corporate users that I'm speaking with focused on finding second generation space that they can improve and put their stamp on it, but not have to build space from scratch, right? There's companies that their whole world, their whole career has been, we build our own space, who are saying, what's out there that we can modify to save money? Because it's that expensive. And the budgets internally on the CapEx side are stretched. Companies are trying to find ways to save CapEx and spending money on office fit out, the way that they carry this on their balance sheet is no different than buying a piece of equipment that's capitalized, right? So at the end of the day, your capital budgets are your capital budgets. And at times you may only have so much capital to deploy. Do you want to deploy it into office space or do you want to deploy it into some other part of your business that generates revenue, right? So it's interesting how the market has shifted, in my opinion, pretty drastically towards finding value versus getting a perfect fit, if other factors are the same.
I mean, in John's example earlier, I mean, you just think of $100 allowance and $225 a foot out of pocket to move to this new space. Yes, you get this super customized outcome that's probably perfect for what the company wants. But John, in your example, right, I'm assuming this is probably a San Diego requirement. I mean, what are annual rents on that transaction?
$40, $45 annual on plus E.
Okay, so you're talking about effectively 3 years worth of rent to have your own space. So when you're going out and looking, you're saying, okay, in order to get $100 foot allowance, it's probably a 10-year deal, maybe even longer. And you're going to end up paying an extra effectively 30% for your tenant improvements, or to, you know, to build out your space from scratch. Or alternatively, we can go do a 5-year lease or a 3-year lease on a space that might only require $20 or $30 a foot of retrofitting and move in. It's like, that's the decision that people are making. But oftentimes, that's the decision arc when you've already decided to move. The decision arc when you're deciding whether to stay or go is effectively, do I want to incur any of this cost? I mean, even in the example of 30 or 40 bucks a foot to move to something that is more or less move-in ready, even that versus doing a 3-year or 5-year renewal, that it's like, hey, I'm paying an extra 20%, even in that example, that I otherwise wouldn't have to spend. So I think the area of the market that is going to perform the absolute worst are the Class B buildings that are just as expensive to construct tenant improvements in as Class A buildings that are in bad condition, that are effectively in shell condition, would be better off being in shell condition because the existing improvements have no value and anyone that's going to come in is going to have to demo them. So you just start thinking about, like, what do you even do in that scenario? Like, how do you effectively have product that you can't move because the re-tenanting costs are so high that even if you did a 10-year lease, even if you only provided 50 bucks a foot, when you factor in your operating expenses, downtime, all these things, it's a money-losing proposition to invest any more money into these buildings. So yeah, it's really crazy. John, I think you wanted to say something else, but you know, once you, you know, chime in here, I think we should talk about all the federal leases that are being canceled. I mean, you think of the quality of space of these federal buildings that are turning back, like, they're effectively unleasable, just in economic, you know, obsolescence effectively, because there's no way to re-tenant them. It just, you can't. Anyways, John, what were you going to say?
I was just going to put a bow on it. I mean, what it means for me is it's really hard to transact. It's really hard to execute a move, which puts interesting pressure on renewal negotiations and renewal dynamics. I think that's true across the board, especially brutal in Class B. But how do we transact when TIs are 200 and 300 a foot and the landlords aren't stepping up to make it their problem?
You guys, if you listen to the Squawk Box in the morning, there's a segment called On the Other Hand. So I was having another conversation with a CFO recently. So if you look at this from a GAAP accounting perspective, it gets really interesting, right? So especially when you went on a renewal, but take that out of the picture right now. If you are a $40 rent plus electric, so say just round numbers, $40 a foot, you have a $100 TI allowance on a 10-year lease. You effectively, on your P&L, you take the $40 a foot, you reduce it by the annual allocation of the TI allowance, because TI allowances from landlords reduce base rent. They don't offset CapEx. So you've got a $40 rent that's offset by $10 a foot. Say you get a month, a year, so it's another 10 months. So that's, you know, that's a $30 rent minus another month of rent. So say it's a $25 rent on your P&L. Now, you got this CapEx, you've got to depreciate over the term of the lease at $300 a foot, which is $30 a foot. But remember, if a company's looking at it in terms of their EBITDA, rent's above the line, depreciation amortization is below the line. So now they just had a $40 rent drop to $25 a foot above the line, reducing their EBITDA. And you've got a asset that you're depreciating below the line, which is your capital. In those scenarios, for the right companies, huge TI allowances, especially if they're not going to spend in the CapEx, right? So what if you get $100 a foot and you have a landlord that allows you to apply that cost to rent? So you're not foregoing that investment, but they allow you to apply it to rent, which we're seeing in this market today for the right deals. So now you actually get to use the money for rent. Plus on your P&L, it is reducing your rent. It's a real opportunity for companies to look at this from a financial structuring perspective and really reduce the cost of their P&L from where they are today. It's super cool.
I think it's interesting to point out what's happening in the life science space, and in particular with the REITs, where tenant improvements are in a slightly different category because of their being judged by funds from operations. So they're a little more free to spend large tenant improvements and some of these life science landlords in the softest markets effectively going to a turnkey offering. So in that case, they are owning the problem and it perhaps it'd be a little bit easier to transact.
Yeah, that's what they're doing here. I mean, it's the floor is kind of 300. The old max was 300. Now that's the floor, and you're seeing it up to turnkey, which could be, 600 a foot, right? Who knows? Now, I think the reason they're doing that is because they believe that what they're building, they're not building highly specialized chemistry space for that. They're building space they believe can be, can be driving value for them through many lease terms or, five-year lease terms. So they're looking at it and saying, like, we're never going to get rent unless we go and do this. And how long, if we build the right space, how long will we get economic value out of it? And in their mind, if they build the right lab space, it could be 5, 10, 15 years or something, right? So, but those are risks they were never willing to take in the past that they now have to step up and spend all this capital. It's scary if you're in that space because there's so much vacancy. There's so much capital deployed already into the base buildings. And then to turn around and turnkey space for a client that probably has no credit, it's not for the faint of heart to be a life science developer right now, unless you're doing deals with big pharma.
I think something else that is interesting to think about is just the impact of interest rates on all of these investments, right? I mean, any fixed income investment is very subject to what's the 10-year treasury, right? Like that's, there's very strong correlation between cap rates and what the 10-year treasury is, the cost to get debt to, construct new buildings or rather, new construction debt is more tied to SOFR, but in terms of permanent financing for a building when it's completed, it's very tied to the 10-year treasury. And we've seen the 10-year treasury rate come down by, effectively like 50 basis points in maybe the last like 30 or 40 days. Like that's pretty significant movement that we've seen things come down. And, obviously not a bond expert by any means, but you just think of, okay, what's the like second order impact on commercial real estate if, Doge is successful in cutting, call it half of our deficit from, reducing that by half. And then there's, reduced regulation and we're able to grow the economy. Like what if effectively the U.S. can get its deficit to zero or maybe even have, a budget surplus and be able to start paying down debt? If such a thing happens, and then, I think it'd be reasonable to think that the 10-year treasury rate is going to come down dramatically compared to what it is today. And all of a sudden, the economics of providing much larger tenant improvement allowances, if you're a landlord, is much easier because your financing rate for that could fall in half. And if that happens, then maybe a lot of these Class B buildings that are, we're saying are functionally obsolete because they can't fund tenant improvements, maybe that puts them below the threshold where a portion of those in the right location are recoverable. Maybe, we know it would have a huge impact on these life science companies that make these massive, very long-term investments to get major returns down the line. So, not to mention that obviously as interest rates go down, it's very likely that we'll see a big uptick in, venture and private equity investment and, probably just more robust economic performance in general. So anyways, we'll see. I think that's a sort of unknown that will have probably the largest impact on the performance of real property assets in general over the next 12 months, more so than anything else.
And or what happens if the 10-year treasury goes up?
Yeah, that would be very bad.
It's an expectation of future pricing. A lot of uncertainty in the market right now.
Yeah, 100%.
A piece of this that I think is interesting is where is the economy though? Because what I've been reading on 10-year treasuries is part of the softening of the rates is because they see the economy slowing, right? So if that's the case, I'm not sure that's going to have the positive impact that we're hoping for. I just saw a stat that the average age of first-time homebuyers is over 50 years old, which is up like 15 years over this data, 20 years ago or something. So I just don't know. Is it too much to wait with if rates do continue to come down, if the economy is slowing? That would be the piece that and I'd be interested to see how this all correlates.
Yeah, and speaking of the economy, let's in office landlords and developers and so forth. Another comment to bring up on the matter of office occupancy and kind of where that's headed. And, you know, we just briefly talked about DOGE. They announced yesterday, guys, that the federal government exceeded $100 million annual in rent savings by canceling about 250 leases, totaling about 3 million square feet. Now, while 250 may seem like a lot, it's not. It's like 3.5% of the what once was the total portfolio of office leases in the country by the federal government of about 7,500. So we're now down to about 7,200 or so. So I imagine, you know, 3% or 3.5% of cutting is not not where the crosshairs were set by DOGE. And I imagine there's more to come. And for those that don't know about GSA leases, they oftentimes have termination options and with quite favorable terms. So when the GSA leases property from a landlord doesn't send the GSA the landlord's lease like they would send your private company or even public company. What they send you, or what the GSA does, is send you the GSA's lease. And the landlord has to capitulate and agree to lease the property based on the government lease, which most often includes termination, cancellation provisions. So there's more to come on that, depending on how many leases get canceled through further efforts of the Department of Government Efficiency. But think about what this does, not only to the country, but think about DC. So there's a DC think tank called the DC Policy Center, and their executive director was quoted this month, in fact, saying that, you know, this deferred resignation deal that the federal workers have and so forth, we're not going to really see the effects of that in the real data until later this summer. It could have a huge effect on the DC market, not to mention those that might have to sell their homes and so forth. But think about the amount of job losses in the federal government and the amount of leases that might be expiring or terminated. And she equated it to a nuclear bomb obliterating the long-term plans of DC's recovery. And just a year ago, it was reported that only 12% of federal workers were even going to the office. And as you can imagine, a majority of the DC office market is occupied by the federal government. And so it's just fascinating to think of, like, I know it may seem hard to fathom, but is DC another Detroit? Where, you know, Detroit in the 1950s had nearly 2 million people. St. Louis in the 1950s had 850,000 people. Today, St. Louis today, it's got like 200,000 people. It's a shell of what it once was. Same with Detroit. Not to mention, Detroit had declared bankruptcy in 2013. And so it's like, gosh, is DC on the verge of a collapse? And unless the federal government, the largest occupant of office space in DC, lawyers. There's 250 law firms that call DC home with over 20,000 lawyers. So it's just, this is all hypotheses and speculation, of course. Nobody's suggesting they have a crystal ball, but this DOGE and this cutting of the workforce and leases could have massive effects on DC.
My take, side story, is for years, if you listen to, we don't have a ton of GSA leases here in Boston, but we have some. If you listen to the brokers that represent owners, they effectively laugh at the face of our government of, oh, their leases, they always overpay. They always sign these long-term leases. Like, the rents are always too high. Well, I kind of love the fact that, yeah, they were overpaying, it sounds like, but they have all these, the brokers failed to recognize that they have termination options. And who wouldn't pay for flexibility? And the difference is, we've never used it as a government, but now they're just ripping up leases, and people are like, wait, you can't do that. Like, what are you doing? And they point to the face rent, but at the end of the day, if you can save $100 million because you can rip up leases, then let's, I think those leases are favorable, or at least fair.
I think DC is in a really dire situation here. I mean, vacancy is already in the low 20% range. Availability is right around 30%. And none of this Doge lease cutting has even hit these numbers yet. I mean, going to Owen's point, I mean, I think it is very scary. I mean, if you own a building occupied by the federal government in DC and they vacate, as we were talking about earlier, you have a building that is short of having a massive repositioning build-to-suit, is effectively economically obsolete, maybe functionally obsolete, depending on, you know, what the exact details are of the building. And a lot of these buildings have really large floor plates. They can't be converted to anything else, and they're just going to languish. And it really makes you wonder, like, what happens to those assets long term? But I mean, Owen, talking about this, you know, DC think tank and, hey, this is the equivalent of a nuclear economic bomb, this and that. I mean, I think in general, having low productivity workers, you know, in the federal government, you know, and I'm operating off the assumption that low productivity people are going to be either fired or take the resignation because they think that they'll be fired because they recognize they're, you know, working from home in their pajamas and, you know, not doing a whole lot. I think maybe those people aren't very self-aware, but the self-aware ones, I think, would take the, you know, 8 months of pay and go look for another job. And if we can actually take a, you know, millions of workers that are not really contributing to the economy and are sort of, you know, not to be harsh, but really leeching off the American taxpayer and just being like, cool, I get paid to, you know, more or less do 10 or 20% of what someone who works in the private sector does. And again, I have no idea what percentage of federal workers are actually not doing stuff. I hope it's not very many. But the people that aren't doing stuff as a taxpayer, that's bothersome to me. And I think it would be great for the economy overall and the country overall, even if it's a detriment to DC, for these people to be shifted to higher productivity portions of the private sector. So anyways, hopefully that happens. I think even if that does happen, though, if there's not a reason for these people to remain in DC, which is obviously an expensive market from a cost of living standpoint, especially compared to other areas, then they're probably going to go somewhere else where there is, you know, better cost of living, more job availability in the private sector. So yeah, I'd be terrified if I owned a house in the suburbs of DC that was expensive. I'd be terrified if I owned an office building in DC. I mean, it could be really, really bad, but I'm bullish on the country if we're able to make those changes and reduce waste.
I agree. I think a couple things. One is, I think that the focus on, and this isn't just you, Tucker, this is in the news every day, the focus that there's somewhat a problem with the worker, the government worker, and the productivity of those government workers. I think they're getting a bad rap, truthfully. I think the focus is there because it's easy, but it's not them. It's the system. We hire, you know, maybe one person in the private sector to do a job would be five people in the government sector. They didn't hire themselves. Someone hired them to do one-fifth of a job that someone could do in the private sector, right? So I think the system is what's broken. And hopefully what we're left with after these cuts is a system that can still operate. And if it isn't, we have the time, we have the leadership to create a new system. Like if, you know, if you go into a company and you lay off 10% of the workforce, the product still gets printed or produced. The product still goes out. There's still a marketing, finance, legal, customer service departments. If we start doing this in the government, can the government actually be nimble enough to produce the product that they need, which is serving the American people, which is kind of scary? Or are we just going to go cut all these people for 4 years, have nobody get what they want, a customer base get really upset, which is the American people, and then 4 years from now, swings the other way and everyone gets rehired and there's no value, right? So I think that's the biggest issue for me right now is we've got this system that's kind of just a mess. And we're not hearing a strategy, but they're all blaming it on the workers that are low productivity. I think that's just a scapegoat. I think get the people out of DC because that's the highest cost market. There's plenty of markets around the country that are one trick ponies. Look at San Francisco. Look at New York after the great financial crisis. Look at Cambridge, Massachusetts when biotech goes. You know, I don't feel bad for property owners. I don't feel bad for the economy because DC has been insulated because the government doesn't operate in a way that has highs and lows like every other industry and every other city. Look at Houston or Calgary after oil busts. It happens. That's part of an economy that goes in cycles. I think DC needs this, but I'm just hopeful that it isn't all scapegoated down to the worker that's, you know, low productivity when it's really the system that's broken, not the people.
Yeah, I bet there's of the people that are low productivity, I bet there's many that would love to be higher productivity. They just aren't really certain how to contribute.
Exactly.
You know, I will say, like, granted, very limited sample size, but the people that work for the federal government that I know are really hardworking, really intense, and frustrated with the, you know, challenges of being productive. So anyways, you know, hopefully yeah. Everyone's happy. Hopefully the economy does great. Hopefully this ends up being a, you know, overall good thing, despite the, you know, massive negative impact it almost certainly will have on DC. But I mean, just to put it in perspective, guys, like, you know, as Owen's saying, they've cut like 3.5% of leases. They probably haven't gotten through the like 7,300 something leases the federal government has. I mean, that takes up, you know, I don't care how many, you know, Doge, you know, people that you've got working, like, it takes a long time to go through 7,300 leases and decide which ones you need and you don't need. So if they've gotten through 10% or whatever, and they've cut $100 million a year, I mean, $100 million a year of rent. I mean, it doesn't say, is that a triple net rent? Is it a full service rent? But just like roughly, that's probably $1.5 billion of value destruction for real property owners. And if they're only 10% through and you're talking about $10, $15 billion of value that just evaporated because the federal government's no longer paying for these leases, like, that's really significant, like really, really significant.
It's tremendous. And it's not 10%, it's 3%. They've only gone through 3% of the leases. So it's crazy to, as you think about what's to come, not to mention, yes, billions of dollars of value erosion, but also, as we've mentioned previously in this podcast, the GSA's office spaces, generally speaking, are spaces that no private company would ever want to lease. I mean, they're government. They're very kind of depressing. And I was thinking about, as we're having this discussion, you know, if you've been to DC, okay, think about the FBI's headquarters, the J. Edgar Hoover building. It's a massive building that spans two city blocks. You can't miss it because it's also the ugliest building in DC, in my opinion, built in 1965. And now this building's not owned by a private investor. It's actually owned by the federal government. There's been a lot of talk about moving this facility. There was once talk of moving it out to Maryland back in 2023, and then that thing kind of derailed, and it remains to be seen what they're going to do. But imagine, even though it's government owned, like, imagine this building coming back to the market. Like, what do you do with it? It's 2.8 million square feet, only of which a million square feet of it's office space. There's a morgue, there's shooting ranges, there's a medical clinic, there's an automobile repair shop. There's all sorts of stuff in there that is, you know, to support the FBI, of course. And I say this in context with those buildings that the GSA leases from private investors, because you got to imagine there's a lot of buildings that are very purpose-driven for the use that the GSA has. And so these aren't, you know, nice office buildings that are appointed well for the private sector. These are office buildings, or office buildings in air quotes, if you will, that probably have some office space, but also some ancillary uses that have absolutely no residual value for anyone in the private sector. So it's pretty scary. I mean, it's scary in the sense of, like, DC, I mean, at least the office market, I'm not trying to suggest that it's doomed, but it could very easily be a replication of Detroit or St. Louis, just given the specialty use of a lot of these buildings. And then if you have a lot of GSA leases in your market, it'd be worth paying attention to.
I was listening to there's owners that do this, that chase GSA leases, but I was in a meeting with a client, a large client, that said, yeah, we had these guys that thought they were the smartest people in the room kind of going in behind us. And every time we leased a new call center, and they were large, you know, a couple hundred thousand foot call centers around the country, they'd go in, they'd buy them up. So they owned, like, I don't know, dozen or two of their call centers, and thought they were the smartest people in the room because this particular company would never leave. Well, they've after the pandemic, they terminated or are trying to sublease every single one of those call centers, right? So you just think about some of these investors like, oh, it's the federal government. We're going to build a REIT around government properties, right? And where are they now? I do want to give credit to, and Tucker, you may have experienced this in your national site search for some clients, but I was listening to Brian Kemp in Georgia, and they just passed a law where the permitting process is 30 days, max, 30 days. And there's under certain situations where I think it's like for TI projects and things that aren't ground up, where you could have a licensed engineer stamp your plans and you don't even need a permit, as long as you have them stamped by an architect and engineer, to completely get rid of the bureaucratic process of being able to get permitting done and move forward with construction, which I just thought was, you know, taking it from a place like Massachusetts that's at times years to get through that process. And on an interiors project, it could be 90 days, 3 months to 6 months, to just, you know, it's such a game changer for, you know, for companies and for being able to get things done in that state. So I thought that was interesting.
So I'll pivot to a positive take on office space. I've had something of a, what I think is an epiphany, around co-working and this idea that, I met a gentleman who is a franchisee for VentureX. That's a franchise operation for co-working across the country. And this guy was a bond trader in New York. Shout out to John Lee. He acquired the franchise to open a VentureX in San Diego in 2022, 2023. He leased a 20,000 foot floor. And I visited with him, and this place is full of energy. It's full of tenants. It's cool looking space. It's got a mix of, you know, desks, some private offices, and great sort of common snacks, coffee, sodas, people sitting and talking. Like, it was so refreshing and interesting. And the fact that just with pure hustle, he went and filled this place up. I've always been sort of negative on co-working, and especially when you think of it as Regus and these private office build outs that for me can be a little bit depressing. And I came to realize, like, with the right operator, that fills a really important segment of the market. And I tend to think of it as the long tail of office leasing, you know, 1, 2, 5 person teams. Because otherwise, what do? You go out and lease 1,000 feet, like these office landlords carving up a multi-tenant floor and dealing with rollover and vacancy and the cost of tenant improvements. Anyway, and look, this is nothing new. This is why CBRE bought Industrious. And I just think, A, there's a real market for this long tail of leasing. Co-working is probably the best way to capture it. And B, over time, I think the idea, like Industrious, more of a management agreement or a hybrid lease where the tenant pays less in base rent but gives participation in top line revenue, more of a partnership. And so shout out to John Lee and VentureX. And I think there's a role for it. And it's cool to see it doing so well in the midst of an otherwise difficult market. He's crushing it.
John, I agree. I think there's a big spot in the market for co-working, especially if done right. But at the same time, I think it is potentially a little bit tricky in that if all of a sudden there's a co-working space on every single building on one floor, then I think the co-working market is way oversaturated. So I think like there's a healthy balance of space being converted to co-working. But if you go beyond this tipping point, then I think everyone that's doing co-working essentially loses their pricing power, has vacancy go too high, and all of a sudden everyone's unprofitable. So it's really, I think it's a bit scary. I mean, I think you can mitigate a lot of the risk by, you know, being a great operator, having the right space, having, you know, competitive underlying lease economics and all that. But I mean, what happens if 2 or 3 or 4 co-working companies lease space in the building across the street from you, start marketing to all your tenants and say, hey, we're half the price for the first year. We just need to get through lease up. So I don't know. I agree. There's always going to be a space for some co-working. I think it's important that we don't get quite into the frenzy that we've gotten into with, you know, WeWork back in the day. I mean, there's a reason that they have exited a massive amount of leases. I mean, it's worth also highlighting that co-working in its heyday was really all around how do we pursue enterprise level companies for massive amounts of space? Like, they were trying to scale the model way more than it deserved to be scaled. And you think of just the amount of companies that failed due to premature scaling or scaling that should have never happened in the first place. And I think that's like the exact thing that has happened in co-working. And the co-working spaces that are focused on, hey, how do we get the, you know, 1 to 5 person companies that don't really want their own space, or even 1 to 10 person companies? I think that's great. It's just never going to be some huge, giant, you know, publicly traded company worth $50 billion like WeWork, you know, thought they were going to be. With those distinctions, I completely agree. That's great. Sounds like that guy running VentureX in San Diego is doing a great job. So cool. Good for him.
Yeah. And this brings me to something I wanted to kind of share for any of the landlords listening to our pod. You know, we're not all contrarians to suggest that the market's going to totally collapse, but, you know, these new leasing strategies that I'm seeing work are indicative of the success that co-working has had. So, John, thank you for bringing this up, because it's a point I wanted to make. You know, office landlords throughout the country right now are getting creative with their own leasing strategies to combat, you know, the co-working model. They're offering spec suites with flexible lease terms and taking floors that were once occupied by office tenants and converting them to hospitality-like amenities to attract the tenants to their building. And those tenants that have space in the building get to use that floor. And so throughout Seattle, we have these landlords, you know, these are institutional landlords in Class A high-rises downtown, literally taking a floor out of their NOI, net operating income, and converting it to just amenity space to offer what co-working offers. And then they're taking other floors in the building and building out space on a speculative basis in nodes of 2,000, 5,000, 10,000 square feet, and fully furnishing them and offering lease terms of a year or two, literally. And so it's, I like the co-working model, but it's interesting to see the landlords that are following this trend. And I wonder, are we going to be ending up in an oversaturation of co-working like space? And that would be a combination of co-working itself and these landlords chasing this new model. But I think the reality is, though, on the bright spot, is that these new leasing strategies are at least working now, because these spec suites are leasing, obviously much, much faster than like your Class D commodity space, which is destined for failure. And so that's kind of a bright spot in the market for landlords listening to this pod. I think also consider Tucker's comment earlier as we kicked off the pod about the Treasury, you know, down 50 basis points. I think you could be thankful for the fact that hybrid work is now stabilizing, or at least getting to the point of stabilization where it allows tenants to make clear decisions on space rather than just downsizing. And I think tech layoffs are slowly stabilizing as well. So there is some good news. And I just wanted to add that for any landlords who listened to the first part of this pod and were thinking it was all doom and gloom. There's some bright spots.
I just want to challenge you on one point where I don't believe they're taking it out of their NOI. I believe they're adding that amenity space into the core factor and effectively getting rent from all the tenants in the building for that space that was otherwise unleased. So it's not altruistic, it's creative. But ask the question, is that square footage showing up in our core factor? By and large, the answer is yes. The Irvine company is an exception here. I asked the question, and I forget which is with. Either they pass through the fitness center square footage, but not the conferencing facility, or they pass through the conferencing facility, but not the fitness center. But they're the only ones I know that have certain allocated spaces that aren't showing up in the core factor. Every other time I ask, it's, oh yeah, that's in the core.
And if the tenants use it, it should be, right? You can't oversize it, but tenants see value in that. They don't have to build large conferencing areas in their space. So in my mind, if built correctly, it's probably a reduction. You know, they're getting something for when they need it at a cost that is incremental to what they would have to spend to have it within their own space. If you remember back, that's what companies used to do before they had these. They'd build these large conferencing areas, or, you know, all hand meeting areas. That's kind of a thing of the past. So I think there's value to it. I've got a client now that just leased space on the same floor as the conferencing center, solely because they want to be able to use it as their own space when they have all hands meetings, and lease it out and also be able to come back and forth between the offices. They have their, you know, all hands meetings and gatherings, which they do on a very frequent basis. So it's going to work really well for them. I think your comment on Industrious, I think CBRE bought Industrious because they're trying to become an investment management company. All of the large real estate firms are doing whatever they can to get out of the service business, non-contractual revenue service business, because there's just too much, there's too much fluctuation in revenue based upon brokerage businesses, and Wall Street hates it. So you're seeing all these firms double down in areas that can be predictable revenue that creates a higher valuation in Wall Street. So that's, you know, you'll see more of this type of acquisition happening across different types of spaces by the large real estate firms as they try to diversify out of pure brokerage work and really become investment companies that cater to owners.
Yeah, if you look at the CBRE earnings report that just recently came out, there was a massive focus on CBRE trying to shift as a company to be more focused on investment management, not as if they're disregarding the other things that they do, like property management and appraisal, capital markets, all that, but very focused on building out this investment management division. And, you know, when you think of any investment management business in general, I mean, it's a great business. Being paid a percentage of assets that you manage and having upside if they perform well and no downside if they don't perform well is a pretty amazing business model if you're able to be profitable just off of management fees and then all of the asset performance is upside. I mean, that's a really good business model. As we were talking about earlier at the start of this episode, Brian, you were, you know, mentioning that, you know, if you were taking, risk as a speculative office developer with other people's money, you'd be all about it. But if it was with your own money, you'd probably wait until you have an anchor tenant. It's like, that's literally exactly what's happening here. It's like, great, let's go way out on the risk curve. Let's manage a ton of assets. You know, some will be core, some will be core plus, some will be more speculative. And the speculative assets, if you knock it out of the park and you hit a, you know, 20% return or 25% annualized return for a, you know, 5-year investment period before selling, it's like, great, you just made $1 trillion on that. And you didn't have any risk. So anyways, pretty interesting. And the dynamic of these companies that are going to be even larger investment managers than they are today, effectively competing with their clients, right? I mean, if you're CBRE or Cushman, and I don't mean to pick on like anyone in particular, because it's all sort of the same, CB, JLL, Cushman, Colliers, Newmark, you name it. If all of a sudden these companies become some of the largest landlords in the country themselves, and you're not them, are you going to hire them to lease your building when they're effectively own the building across the street? And like, they have a really perverse incentive to try and drive people to assets that they get upside in as an owner or as a, you know, an investment manager. I mean, they are effectively the owner just with a bunch of limited partners and investors putting money behind them. And it becomes even worse if they're, you know, continue to try and represent tenants, right? When you think, okay, hey, all of a sudden, say fast forward 10 years, CBRE is an excellent company, right? They've been super successful at basically everything that they've done. Say that this vision comes to life and they become one of the largest owners of real property in the US or even globally. How, like, they probably just have to do away with representing companies like occupiers altogether because the conflicts would just be so, so crazy.
I think the conflicts are there now. I think they would never walk away from that business because no one's calling them on it, right? It gets really scary. So my career, I've been at larger firms and I've watched how companies trust and their advisors globally to help them make decisions in markets that they don't understand the factors. And as you get into the Asian markets and you get into the European markets, the amount of information, you think the markets here are illiquid and doesn't have a lot of public information, wait till you get into those markets. It's very, very difficult to understand who the owners are behind buildings, who leases the building, who's the asset manager on the building. It's just really hard. And you know, the companies trust these large global outsourcing firms to manage all of those conflicts for them and manage that information. And, you know, when I was there 10 years ago, it put me in a difficult position because I'm always upfront with that. And we put on all of our surveys and globally, like who leases the building, who owns the building, who's the asset manager on the building? Because a lot of times in international markets, the asset manager is not the owner. The owners are high net worth individuals or families, especially in the Asian markets. But the asset manager who owns maybe a small piece or gets paid based on the success of the building, plus carried interest as you'd use in the private equity world, they're these large real estate firms. So they're starting to put surveys together, and it's all of a sudden every building on the survey or 90% of the buildings on the surveys are buildings that they represent. And it's like, no, we need to start over. I know there's more buildings in the market. I know we could do this better. And that's what drove me away from these firms, among other things. There's conflict so apparent if you just take a look. And the further you get away from that leadership team or the headquarters location for that client, the more it just becomes part of doing business with these larger firms. It's really scary. And it's not any particular one. It's all of them.
Yeah. I have experience with the big firms. And I think this comment goes to any company that becomes one of the largest owners of office space, industrial space, whatever it might be, that also tries to serve the needs of a tenant. You know, the reality is this, and I think there's probably four or five things they're going to tell you, you being the corporate tenant. They're going to tell you that there's a firewall in place and that their tenant rep team, you know, is totally independent from their investment and asset management divisions. But internal information, guys, inevitably seeps through. That's just a reality. They all share the same printer, is what I like to say. They might emphasize that they disclose ownership interests up front. Okay, great. So you're telling me that they own the building. That doesn't change the fact that their incentives are massively misaligned when they're trying to serve two people. Someone's got to win, or the two parties have to each get mediocre results. I mean, that's the reality there. They'll probably suggest that they have massive amounts of data because of all the tenants and landlords they might represent. But how is that an advantage to the tenant if the landlord is benefiting from the same data? Okay. That's not an advantage. And, you know, they'll push the idea of being a landlord and a broker gives them really good insight, right? Into structuring deals. But again, that's great for the landlord too. And it would give the firm, whoever is owning these buildings, every incentive to push their own properties first. So it's a really, really hard conversation that they're going to have. And obviously, it's going to be up to the buyer to determine whether or not they consider those conflicts to be real or perceived. But those are the facts as I see them.
So the way I look at it, it comes back to this. I always often say there's no such thing as market rent. And this idea of market rent pricing, I think we tend to emphasize negotiations in a significant way, especially in this market. We talk a lot about price discovery. Like, what in the world is the office worth today? Well, we're going to go find out through a process, robust negotiations. And for these largest companies that are transacting around the globe, it becomes, I think, more about transaction management and managing the process. It's really hard to dive deep into negotiations on everyone when you've got 1,000 leases rolling. So for some of these larger client engagements, it's less about artful negotiation and more about managing a process, a transaction process. And the problem is there is no real market rent. Everyone on the premise that there's a market rent pricing and we're going to get some version market. You're comfortable with a conflicted agent because they're just sort of managing that process for you. But once you accept the idea that, no, there is no, it's not like the stock market with buyers and sellers resetting the price of a share of stock every second. Every piece of real estate is different. Every landlord is different. The tenant is different. Over time, things change. Like, I just think our worldview, every client assignment is about a negotiation, where I think in a full service organization, it becomes more about managing a process because there's so many sites and so many, for these largest CREs. And I think our worldview is different. We look at every transaction as that opportunity for negotiation to go figure out what the market pricing should be.
Well said, John. Okay, let's wrap up there. That's episode 50. Thanks so much, everyone, for listening. Covered a lot today. We'll be back with episode 51 in a couple of weeks. Thanks.